You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new documentary out tonight from Wisconsin Public Television and UW-Madison is looking at the challenges that come with providing health care in rural Wisconsin. We talked to a producer of the documentary and a public health expert. First, the United Nations predicts that by 2050, 2 out of every 3 people in the world are likely to be living in cities or other urban centers. And census data here at home suggests more and more Americans are moving to cities as well. Those trends can mean big challenges for small towns across the country, but there's also room for opportunity, according to our next guest. In a new piece, he lays out his ideas for not only attracting tourists to small towns, but also making them desirable places for people to live and work. Roger Zelnoritis is the Economic Development Manager for the Southern Ute Indian Tribe, headquartered in Ignacio, Colorado. His recent piece for the website Governing is 3 Keys to the Economic Viability of Small Towns. Roger, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. I appreciate it.
Well, before we get into the recommendations you lay out in your piece, can you talk about some of the economic challenges facing small towns these days?
Yeah, you know, in one respect, the economic challenges small towns are facing hasn't really changed in, say, 300 years since industrialization began. But we've really seen an acceleration in the last 30 years, maybe since the early 80s or so. And this decade is the first time in the United States that rural areas lost population, not just as a percentage, but for people were actually leaving rural areas after the recession, which was surprising because a lot of rural areas did well during the recession. I think what's happening and what you see going on is something of the effect of globalization. It's something of the effects of how more and more human capital doesn't need to be located anywhere near the natural capital that things get created out of. So one example I like to use, because I visited McDowell County, West Virginia, a few years ago, is the coal industry. You know, when you go into Welch, West Virginia, it's a town of 400 people, and there's 6- and 7-floor buildings downtown, because that's where the coal companies used to be headquartered in the 1920s. And those coal companies eventually became headquartered in Charleston, West Virginia, and then they got bought and moved to Pittsburgh. And now you look these days, and 4 of the 5 largest coal companies on Earth are in India, China, South Africa, and Australia, and the one that was in the United States went bankrupt. So the connection that you need to have as a coal company to a coal mine or where the coal reserves are located, they have nothing to do with each other anymore. It can go through industry after industry like that. And the challenge is, how do you keep those high-value jobs in rural areas? And I think it's become much more pronounced again in the last 30 years than we've seen in times past.
Now, this piece you've written, 3 Keys to the Economic Viability of Small Towns, who is your target audience? Who are you really reaching out to here?
I have to admit, I've started by just thinking about my area out here in Southwest Colorado and speaking to the business leaders and community leaders out here. But I think there's something applicable as well, because on the flip one hand, you know, if you're in the Rocky Mountains like we are, it's easy to talk about quality of life. But there are all sorts of quality of life positives no matter where you live in a rural community throughout the country. So there are things, so, you know, people say, wow, you got these great amenities, great vistas, greater. Every town's got something great about it. So I wanted to kind of broaden the message and say, how do you take advantage of those things that make your town unique, make it great in order to attract people and to grow your local economy?
And you give kind of a 3-part suggestion: stop, live, and work. And I want to take those one at a time. Let's talk about stopping, getting people to consider even just visiting your small town community, wherever it is. What kind of things should people be thinking about?
You know, when it comes to stopping in a town, it's what I first is what I call reactive versus proactive. So reactive is an example of you're driving across the country. It's 6:30 or 7 at night. You're exhausted. You just want to find a place to grab dinner and grab a room. If your town has a hotel and a restaurant, great, you might get that person. But that's reactive. That's answering to somebody's needs. Proactive means defining yourself based on some unique thing about your town. It could be, you know, back east, it could be a Civil War battle that took place. It could be a monument. It could be some historical architecture or a figure that grew up there. It could be a really unique event that takes place only in your town. But what is it that kind of is the draw that makes your town one of a kind that would then bring people in with a like-minded interest so they will deliberately go to your town rather than just happening to be there on their way to some other place? And that's where it began. But also, as you think about that, as you're defining that unique feature, you're starting to brand what your town is all about, too.
And I've watched in process, in some cases, towns try to come up with this brand identity, this what makes them unique and distinct, and it is harder to do than to say.
It is, and one thing is you've got to be authentic. And, you know, that's one of the opportunities small towns have and any community has. Is there's this search for authenticity this day among a lot of people. But it can't just be something you make up whole cloth. Well, let's become the world's leader in, sheep herding. If there's no sheep out there, you have no history in sheep, that's not going to do it for you. You've got to find something that's something unique in your town. And, like, I'll just pick on a town just to our south. It's Farmington, New Mexico. They've gotten a lot of bad press lately. They're known as an oil and gas community, and there's a lot of oil and gas down there. But they also have the Connie Mack World Series. So I've often thought, well, what if they could rebrand themselves around the Connie Mack Baseball League and have a baseball town out in the Four Corners? So it has to be unique, and it can be a struggle, but it's something that should be fairly intuitive and perhaps controversial as well to residents. You know, they'll get it. They'll understand it. They'll see what that means for their town.
We're talking about how to rebuild viable economies in small towns around the country. Roger Zalnaritis is with us, economic development manager for the Southern Ute Indian Tribe. He wrote about this for Governing Magazine. Okay, Roger, stop is step one. Live is step two, creating a place that people will want not just to visit but to live in. How do you do that?
Well, this is kind of the home message for me out here in Southwest Colorado, because we focus so much on the amenities out here. Let's build parks, let's build bike paths, let's build, all this stuff to attract people in. But in the end, if you don't have great neighborhoods, you're not going to be able to keep people in your area. And that really begins with quality housing, that begins with safety. It's the same thing any of us ask when we move to a new town. You go to a real estate agent, you're looking to buy a house, and almost the first two questions out of your mouth when you go see a house is, okay, well, how are the schools and how safe is the neighborhood? So you start with those basics. Okay, let's make sure our neighborhoods are attractive and have good people living in them as well. Let's make sure the neighborhoods are safe. And that means working with your police force and working with your schools in order to build up those quality neighborhoods. A lot of rural areas are seeing population decline. And so between expensive housing you see in some places and declining areas, blight, I think, is the more important issue. So when you have vacated houses, abandoned lots, what are you doing to address that and get rid of that problem that you have in your community? That's what I wanted to emphasize in that part is start with the basics. Start with your infrastructure, your schools, your safety, then build up toward those things that really start, being the wow factor that everybody's after these days, whether it's an arts district or your parks or something else like that.
And so for those people who are going to live there, that could be, keeping the younger people there. It could be bringing retirees in, say, if it's a nice place to retire to. But whatever the community is, you want to make it a decent place to live.
Right. Now you've got if you do that, you've got your identity. Now you've got a decent place to live for those young people or those retirees or whoever happens to be moving there. And you're well on your way to being able to kind of either stop your decline or continue your growth, one of the two.
And then step three, stop, live, and then work.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the work, I kind of wanted to put that last because, again, if you're focusing work first, basically what you're doing is building a business park. You're not building a town. The other issue is that a lot of people now, jobs are becoming much more mobile. And that's one of the, although everything's moving into big cities and is moving across the ocean and everything, more and more people have the option to live wherever they want to live. Either because they're home-based workers, so they're just working from home, and they just need a good internet connection, or it's because they work for themselves or sole proprietors, and they can do what they want where they want. And those folks they're some of the fastest-growing segments in the national economy right now, and they're looking for more of the authenticity of something that reaches into their values as to what they're going to want to live near. Or live in, I should say, as well. So that's why you start with that brand identity and those quality neighborhoods, because if somebody comes and they like what your community is about and it resonates with them and they see good neighborhoods and they can take their job with them, they're going to be a lot more likely to bring it to your town than just by chance stopping there. And I would also emphasize that a lot of these people then do go on to create companies. Some of them go on to create companies, but they're eventually could be your employers in town as well. So, if you start with that identity that attracts people, you will have the jobs that follow them.
Now, here in Wisconsin and around the country, as we said at the outset, there is concern about, population going down in small towns, economic decline. In our last few moments, do you see bright spots? Do you see people turning this trend around?
There are a lot of bright spots out there. And one of the interesting things, I found this at the University of Minnesota's Extension Office. They did a study called Rural Brain Gain. and they were able to use census demographics to figure out where people between the ages of 25 and 40, or 30 and 40, I should say, were moving within Minnesota out to rural areas. And so one of the highlights they said is people that were moving to rural areas tempted to do so for a simpler life, safety and security, affordable housing, outdoor recreation, and quality schools were a lot of the findings they had. But the fact is, a lot of communities are starting to attract people as they're getting married or as they're starting to think about, you know, let's have kids, or maybe we're not going to have kids, but we still want to live in a kind of family-friendly place. They look either to the exurbs or they tend to look more toward hometowns or small towns where they're from or where they'd like to live and raise a family. So the towns that can be attractive to those, I'd say not the 20-year-olds, the 20 to 25-year-olds, they tend to want that big city, bright lights, atmosphere for a while. But as people are starting to settle down into their 30s, they're starting to think more of, okay, you know, downtown mega city is not what I want to call home anymore. I want to call home someplace that has that community feel.
And we'll leave it there. Roger, that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. You have a good day.
You too. That's Roger Zalnaritis, Economic Development Manager for the Southern Ute Indian Tribe, talking about small town economies. Coming up, a look at rural healthcare access around Wisconsin. That's next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, when we see racial harassment in public or encounter offensive remarks in our own social circles, knowing when to say something can be tricky. Our guest offers advice about when and how to intervene. First, finding the right doctor can be hard. For people living in rural parts of Wisconsin, it can be even more difficult. A new documentary from Wisconsin Public Television and UW-Madison is taking a closer look at the challenges of providing quality health care in rural Wisconsin and highlighting efforts by UW-Madison to address those challenges. Mary Picorni Donlin is a producer with Wisconsin Public Television, and Dr. Amy Kine is a geriatrician and director of the Health Services and Care Research Program in the Department of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. They are both involved in the new documentary Medicine on Main Street, which airs tonight at 9:30 on your local WPT station. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Kine, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Mary, let's start with you. What got you interested in tackling this issue of rural health care?
Rob, this is actually the fourth in a series of programs that we've been co-production with the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And what we do is we kind of find a topic that's important to Wisconsin, and then we figure out what ways we can bring UW-Madison into it, what impact they've had on the programs with various topics. And so this year, we decided to do rural health care. It's an issue not only in this state, but actually nationwide. What is UW-Madison? What programs that they have that are addressing these issues in underrepresented rural health care, and then what is the impact in the communities?
And Dr. Kine, I know you've been looking at these disparities and coming up with ways to track them and visualize them for people. Can you paint us a picture of what we're facing in terms of rural health care disparities?
Yes, absolutely. Our rural areas of our state and of many states across the nation are facing an unparalleled challenge in terms of health care access, healthcare delivery, and health outcomes. There's much improvement to be made. And to raise awareness of some of the challenges that the rural areas are facing, I think is of great importance. And I'm so thrilled that Wisconsin Public Television has taken this on as a focus for their series.
And Mary, what did you hear from residents in towns that you went to when they talked about access to healthcare?
It's always been a struggle for them. The idea that they'd have to travel like miles, they have to drive an hour to get to a specialist, or they're having a lack of mental health providers in the area. And so they were actually very happy that they had healthcare professionals in their area that made it easy for them, that they could see a specialist once every month and not have to come to Madison. And so there's misconceptions about that you're going to get less quality healthcare in these rural areas, when in fact they're getting great care, and just so they don't have to come to Madison. But yeah, they're getting it right there in their communities.
Yeah, Dr. Kine, can you talk about UW-Madison's outreach efforts to help provide that care, maybe especially that specialty care that people don't have usually in their neighborhood?
absolutely. The University of Wisconsin is at the cutting edge of outreach to all corners of our state. We have pioneered new technologies and new care models to allow for telemedicine-based approaches in which specialists or other healthcare providers are at one location but can deliver care in another location through technology. We've also innovated around new ways to deliver care within low-resource settings. For instance, trying to support older adults more successfully as they move from hospital to home or recover from whatever illness that they have in their homes, even if they've received care in another site. Additionally, we have this wonderful program called the Wisconsin Academy for Rural Medicine, which was specifically created to address physician shortages within our state of Wisconsin. And this is a wonderful program that brings in medical trainees who are often from rural areas, are interested in going back to rural areas after their medical training, and wonderfully, 91% of the graduates of this program thus far are practicing in the state of Wisconsin. So it has been an unqualified success. And I would say, though, that there are certainly many other programs that I can't speak to today, but there is always more need. And there's always more need for new health policies and new approaches and additional persons and programs to help address our rural health needs. So the increased attention and the raising of awareness that has been done through this new Wisconsin Public Television series is really wonderful in my eyes.
And Mary, you talked to Dr. Kind and other medical professionals as part of the documentary. Can you talk about kind of the range of things that you saw doctors doing when they went out to work in rural Wisconsin or telecommuted to rural Wisconsin, for that matter?
Yeah, it was great. We wanted to make sure that we didn't just focus on the physicians, but we were looking at nursing and pharmacists. So we found a wonderful doctor, Dr. Michelle Forrestein, in Black River Falls. It was actually a graduate of the WARM program. We found Erin Adams, who is a mental health nurse practitioner that actually lives in Madison, but she commutes to Dodgeville and Lancaster, which is that happens in a lot of communities. Doctors and nurses have to commute to get to these and cover several counties. And then we met two wonderful pharmacists in the Rice Lake Hayward area. So we wanted to make sure we got out across the state and really got a good representation of the healthcare professionals and the great work that they're doing in their communities.
Dr. Kind, you track differences in communities when it comes to access to healthcare, and you mentioned outcomes. Connect the dots. How big a difference does it make to have access to primary and specialty care when it comes to longer-term health outcomes?
Oh, it can make a huge difference. And this is certainly a deeply personal question and topic for me. Having grown up in rural northern Wisconsin, I personally saw the impact of limited access to specialty and primary care services directly being linked to health outcomes in the area, health outcomes surrounding diabetes or childhood wellness, maternal fetal outcomes, trying to find practitioners who could deliver someone, for instance, within a reasonable area. And so when health outcomes are so tightly linked to access, it becomes absolutely critical that our state institutions like the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine Public Health invest in new technologies and new opportunities for training to try to keep our best and brightest within our own state. And so I'm glad to say that that is what we're doing and we're continuing to move in that direction. But there is no doubt, study after study after study within the research community on a whole array of outcomes from cradle to older adult show that access to high quality health services is absolutely essential to good quality health.
Mary, I've heard from other guests over the years that access to healthcare isn't just about the health of individuals, but the health of communities. And, you know, people might base a decision on where to live or retire to, depending in part on access to healthcare. Did you get that sense? I know that wasn't the main issue you were tackling, but did you get that feeling like this is important to us as a community?
You did. You really got that sense. It's just you're going to meet, when you watch tonight, you're going to meet this one woman, Mona Baker, who moved up here from Dallas, Texas. Had access to, you know, top-notch specialist or whatever, and so she was going to come up here, move closer to her son, and she had real concerns about that, what kind of health care. And she fell in love with the system immediately. She needed a knee replacement within a month of moving here, and she could not believe the quality of it. In fact, she found the advantage of, instead of having to drive 2 hours to a hospital, she only drove 10 minutes, and it was just wonderful. So she was really impressed by that. But you saw that in anywhere. The pharmacists that we focus on in Hayward and Rice Lake, they just think that the quality of health care that they get from their pharmacies is they can't even measure that. It's just wonderful. And it's especially important, especially in these small towns, for pharmacies. If you think about it, they could be the only healthcare professional in town. Mm-hmm. And people that are coming there to get their medications, they don't need an appointment, they don't need insurance, but there's a healthcare professional right there that they can ask these questions to. And that's why pharmacists especially are a very vital part to all these communities.
Dr. Kind, I know you're trying to bridge some of these gaps. Where is there still room for improvement around the state? Whether that's coming from UW-Madison or the state or local communities, where do we need to fill gaps?
So I think there are always lots of areas of improvement. The people and the healthcare providers within these rural areas do such a wonderful, wonderful job that I think one of the things that we could do as a society is do a little bit better job of supporting them and in their work. So reaching out to our policymakers, reaching out to our decision makers, and helping them understand that rural medicine is absolutely critical to the health of our population, that it needs to be supported, and that some of our rural hospitals are in real crisis here and across the state, that these problems need to be attended to, and we need to maintain our rural healthcare infrastructure in a way that allows people, regardless of where they live in the state of Wisconsin, and particularly within these rural areas, to access high-quality services at all times.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Kind, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Mary, thanks for coming over to our side of the building.
Thank you, Rob.
Mary Picorni Donlin is a producer with Wisconsin Public Television, and Dr. Amy Kind is a geriatrician and director of the Health Services and Care Research Program in the Department of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. They joined us to talk about a new documentary premiering tonight on WPT about healthcare access in rural parts of the state. The documentary is called Medicine on Main Street. You can watch it on your local WPT channel tonight at 9:30 or online at WPT.org. Coming up, we'll talk about the best ways to intervene when we encounter racist behaviors, whether it's from strangers in public or from friends and family. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, a fossil find in North Dakota may show the first signs of extinction after a major meteor impact, but there's some controversy about the find. Kate Archer-Kent talks to the scientist behind the new report. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, when we encounter behavior that targets someone for their race, religion, or sexuality, whether it's outright harassment in public or an offensive joke at a family get-together, knowing when and how to intervene can be difficult. Should we just let certain comments go? How do we step in without risking a dangerous confrontation? This Friday, Lawrence University in Appleton is hosting a free workshop open to the public that will help people navigate some of those difficult situations. Kimberly Barrett is Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion and Associate Dean of Faculty at Lawrence University. Kimberly, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
Well, this training focuses on the bystander in different kinds of incidents. Why is it important to focus on that role of maybe that third party in a racist incident?
Well, you know, most of us want to be the person who's doing the right thing. You know, although we hear a lot about increased hate crimes and that kind of stuff, the things that happen every day are usually more subtle. And, you know, it really would be helpful to reduce prejudice in general if we were able to confront that prejudice on an individual basis.
A lot of people might have been in a situation where, in hindsight, they think back and think, oh, I could have handled that differently. Should I have done something? What should I have done? What kind of training will be given on Friday to help people have a, I guess, toolkit before the incident happens?
Well, we'll take some real-life situations and sort of guide people through different alternatives for dealing with them. And actually, Fit Oshkosh will be doing the training, an organization outside of the university, but we bring them in several times a year. And actually, we also have some of our own student leaders and others who do additional training on this.
And is this something you're focusing on in particular there at Lawrence University?
Well, I think that it's one of the many things that we do to try to make our campus more inclusive. You know, there are things, you know, we hear a lot about Title IX, we hear a lot about non-discrimination, but many times the kind of bias that can really impact somebody's ability to learn or to do their job well are everyday things that happen. And so we want to give people, as you said, the tools to be able to respond to these things in ways that really empower everyone in our community to make a difference.
Talking to Kimberly Barrett, Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion and Associate Dean of Faculty at Lawrence University, about a training there in Appleton, helping bystanders intervene safely and effectively when they see different kinds of racist incidents. And Kimberly, I want to throw out some different scenarios here and get your thoughts. Obviously, you'll go into more depth at these trainings. But let's take if we see in public just an outright somebody harassing someone else based on, say, a racial difference. What kind of things can we think about so that everybody stays safe, but we can say something?
Well, I think that there are a number of ways that you can intervene. I think doing something is better than nothing. Even if you think it's awkward, even if what you do is try to deflect the situation with a joke or intervene by asking someone for directions or the time, doing anything to stop it is better than just watching it happen. If it's a situation where you don't think it's safe to interject yourself, then you should call the authorities, you should call the police.
And there can be a situation, and I think people have maybe observed this, where something like this is going on, and there are multiple thinking, should I do something? How can someone take that first step and maybe encourage others to join in as well?
Well, like anything, you know, practice makes perfect. You know, it's always hard to start doing something you've never done before. And so I would say, you know, go to a training or even just, you know, there's lots of information online. I think just come up with a couple of things that you could say in a situation where, let's say, a family member is making an inappropriate joke or someone is doing something that you think really is an example of bias, and have a couple of phrases, just interrupting it by saying, well, I never thought about it like that. Here's how I see this. Or, you know, I know that you didn't mean to do this, but this is, you know, how I heard it, or this is how it may affect some people. So it doesn't have to be hitting somebody over the head, you know, with a bag of bricks or anything. It can be just subtle to make people pause for a minute and think about what they're saying. Because most of us are not intentionally harassing people. Now, when it's intentional, then you might need to either do a group intervention or, as I said earlier, call the police.
Yeah, let's talk about that situation you were just alluding to there. It's not, you know, a dangerous, hostile situation. It may be something that someone says who we otherwise, you know, respect, maybe love, someone who's close to us. Can you talk a little more about how to raise, I think, what a lot of people find a difficult issue of, hey, this might be a racist thing. How do we tackle that?
Well, it's always less threatening if you begin with I statements. You shouldn't make assumptions about what the person's motives are because, you know, we really can't read anybody else's mind. So start with an I statement, and you might start by just talking about how it makes you feel. You know, I feel this way when you say or do this thing, please don't do this anymore. Or you could just stop with the, this is how this makes me feel. I think, you know, publicly supporting the person who is sort of the target of the joke, if there's somebody in the room, in the vicinity, who's the target, so publicly sort of supporting them. I think just interrupting the behavior in any way that you can. I think it's important to intervene in ways that are what I like to say, calling people in rather than calling them out. We've all heard that phrase that you get more bees with honey, right? You earn more by asking people to be part of the solution rather than making them feel like they're less than because of a mistake they made.
There's a temptation, I assume, for a lot of people to just let something go. Oh, that's just so-and-so, or, oh, they're never going to change. It's not worth the potential confrontation. What would you say to people in that situation?
Well, the research bears out that it really does change prejudiced behavior if you call somebody on it. And it doesn't have to be calling them out in a, you know, some embarrassing way, just telling them about it. Sometimes you could call them aside after the event and say, look, I know you didn't intend this, but let's think about what you were saying here and the impact it may have. Also, it makes you feel better. You know, when you confront as you were saying at the beginning of the show, when you confront the behavior, you then don't have to go back and think, oh my gosh, I wish I would have done this or that in the moment. If you go ahead and confront, even if it's awkward, you'll feel better and you'll decrease the likelihood that person will engage in prejudice in the future. Also, when you don't intervene, then you think that it's wrong, you experience what we call cognitive dissonance. And so then you begin to justify the behavior of the other person and, you know, to justify why you didn't intervene. And so it really helps you if you act in ways that are consistent with this sort of belief that you're not prejudiced and that bias is wrong. It helps you be a better person. And really, we think about this as being very hard. It's easier than you think. It doesn't take a lot of special expertise, but it does take a little thought ahead of time as to, you know, how you might get somebody to pause, think, or how you might remove somebody who's a target from that situation safely. So having a few ideas in mind really helps. And, you know, as I said, it can be something as easy as, wow, I never thought about it like that. Or, what did you mean? Did you mean to say, you know, this thing? So just some questions. It doesn't have to be a statement calling someone racist or homophobic. It could just be some questioning so that they stop and think about what they're saying.
For people who aren't on the receiving end of racism, it can feel, I think, a lot easier to not talk about it than to talk about it. What would you say to encourage people to make that advanced preparation like you've been talking about and be ready for that situation?
Well, the fact of the matter is, if we don't intervene, if we are passive bystanders, then we are really just promoting the transmission of bias in our society. We're promoting racism, we're promoting sexism, we're promoting, religious intolerance, all of that when we don't say anything. Silence really is complicity.
Kimberly Barrett is with us, Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion at Lawrence University in Appleton. We're talking with her about how to intervene in situations where we see a racial harassment or offensive jokes and comments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have there been situations where you've stepped in to try to stop harassment or call out racist comments? Were there times where, in hindsight, you wish you could have done something but didn't know what to say or do? How do you handle those uncomfortable moments and conversations about race? And do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Kimberly Barrett, Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion at Lawrence University, about when and how to interrupt racist behavior. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever stepped in to stop someone harassing others because of their race, religion, or sexuality? What happens when somebody makes a comment that you think is kind of crossing a line? Do you say something? Do you regret not saying something later? How do you handle that? And do you have questions for our guest about how to handle these situations? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls. We have Elizabeth on the line with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a situation in December where I was with family, having a lovely family gathering, and they started talking about people at their work that were from Mexico and how their lunches smelled. And that just disturbed me. And I just finally said, you know what? Don't you have lunches that also smell? Food smells. I don't understand why you're saying that. So that was just one of many different types of situations that I've encountered within my own family.
And Elizabeth, before we let you go, how did people react, if I can ask?
Actually, they didn't say much after that. I think they were pretty surprised that I would call them on that one. So I was happy about that.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. Kimberly, your thoughts. It might sound to people like a small thing, but Elizabeth spoke up there.
I know. I want to say thank you, Elizabeth, because that really makes people think about what they're saying and the impact. And when you don't say anything, they just assume that you think and feel the same way. And so just introducing an alternative way of thinking about it, I think, makes people stop and have a better understanding of the impact of what they're saying.
Thanks a lot for the call, and we'll go now to Martha in Menominee. Martha, hello.
Oh, good afternoon. This is a great topic. You know, my perspective is I was just raised that if you don't call out racism when you see it, you're complicit. So I do it all the time. I have all my life, and it does get easier. So for those people that are a little backed off about saying something, you'll get your spiel down after a few practice tries, and it does get easier. And if you use humor, that always helps.
Martha, so you go with more honey than vinegar, as Kimberly was saying earlier?
And I go with I feign surprise and shock. I pretend to be, really? You voted for Trump? I didn't know you were racist. And then we get into a discussion from there.
Martha, thanks for the call. Kimberly, your thoughts on what Martha had to say?
Well, I think using humor, and I think Martha went a bit towards sarcasm, but using humor can be a very effective way to, again, sort of get people to think about what they're saying and to interrupt sort of biased statements. And so you have to be kind of careful with humor, though. You don't want it to trivialize the situation, but I think it can be a very effective tool.
And it sounded from Martha's comment that she made there, like she might be a little confrontational sometimes from the one example she gave.
Well, and it really depends on the relationship you have with the person, the relationship you want to have with them after the encounter, and how well you know them. I mean, if it's somebody that's close, that you have a very good relationship with, that you can just be very frank with, then, you know, go at it. If it's somebody that you don't know so well, or somebody that you are getting to know or in the workplace and want to continue to have a good relationship, you might want to be less confrontational.
Thanks for the call. We'll go now to Stephanie with us in Madison. Stephanie, hello.
Hi. So I've had friends and some close family members make some racist comments, and I've tried to confront them, just saying, I wish you wouldn't say stuff like that, and, you know, kind of the, come on, what are you doing? And sometimes they get the response of, you know, how do you think you have the right? Or they make me seem kind of that holier than thou, and how do I get why do I think I have the right to confront them about that? So I'm wondering, how can I respond when that's the response I get?
Well, I think one thing is to acknowledge that they're right. We all have learned racist ideas in our society. We've all learned all the isms. And so once we're aware of that, then we need to try to unlearn those, and that's what you're doing. So I think share with them, yes, I mean, sort of lean into that and explain that it is pervasive. And not only do you think that they're engaged in that behavior now, but yeah, sometimes you do as well, but you're working on it and you'd like them to work on it as well.
Thanks for the call, Stephanie. We are talking to Kimberly Barrett from Lawrence University, talking about intervening when we see a racist harassment or racist language in our lives, what to do, how to do it, when to do it. Before we go back to our callers, Kimberly, thoughts for people who are maybe in charge of an organization, say a business owner or manager. What can they think about to set a, I guess, a, set up a workplace culture where maybe you don't even need to intervene?
Well, I think you definitely have to set the expectations in terms of having policies, accessible ways that people can, you know, make complaints, have training for supervisors. That's probably the most important thing you can do in creating an inclusive workplace and promoting non-discrimination. And so I think, training in the workplace is important, and just having it as part of your company values that people hear over and over again, and that then your behavior follows that.
Let's go back to our callers now. Ben is with us in Lodi. Ben, hi.
Hi. Thanks for doing this topic. I have one question. Sometimes people belonging to a certain group use self-deprecating humor. In other words, they talk about themselves and others belonging to their affinity group in stereotypical ways, kind of poking fun at themselves. How is a bystander to react to that?
Well, you really have to look at sort of the power differentials and whether you're part of that group, that marginalized group that is using self-deprecating humor. Most of the time, I would say steer clear of that. I don't think that that is really, that's a whole different issue. And I think that it will be more detrimental to think about that in the same way. I think if you're a member of the in-group who's doing that and you think that it's problematic, then you should say something, and then you can have a conversation. But if you're not a member of that group, I would say it wouldn't be very helpful to intervene in that way.
Ben, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. Jane is with us in Madison. Jane, hello.
Hi, how are you? I am calling from Madison. I actually wanted to just tell a little story about when I was in class at UW-Madison. One of my lecturers made a comment about how the U.S. government was well-meaning in their in their institutionalization of Native American children. And I, raised my hand and I said, I don't think there is really anything well-meaning. I think it was more of an issue of cultural genocide. And she ended up kind of taking a step back and ended up emailing the class about, how she was sorry, and she, extrapolated on the issues with that sort of language. So I think it could be more beneficial for even just the person you're speaking to, but all the people who are listening as well.
Jane, yeah.
Thanks for the call. Kimberly, when there's that power differential, a student, professor, employee and boss, that kind of thing, how can people handle that?
Well, I think that the caller was very brave and very appropriate in an educational institution to bring up a different view. And then the faculty member, it sounds like, acted appropriately, reacted appropriately as well, and sort of brought in a bigger conversation about the complexity of, the experience of Native Americans, Indigenous people, in the United States and actually around the world. And so I think that, this is just an example of why it's important to be willing to speak up. There could be personal cost when there are power differentials, so you really have to think about how to do that. Sometimes you might not want to do it in the moment. You might wait until after class, go to the, office hours and say, have you thought about this? And have that discussion. Again, you have to sort of look at, so what's the most effective way to do this and when? And so it you know, this was worked out really well. Depending on personality, you might want to take a different approach. But I think in any case, you should bring these issues up.
Kimberly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Kimberly Barrett, Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion and the Associate Dean of Faculty at Lawrence University. She joins us to talk about interrupting racist behavior. Lawrence University is hosting a free bystander, upstander workshop on their campus in Appleton this Friday. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at the governor's budget plans for health care in Wisconsin with the new Secretary of the State's Health Services Department. And greeting card sales are down in the United States. We'll find out what's behind that trend and ask if you still send cards. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6:30, a lot of Wisconsin dairy farmers have closed up shop or filed for bankruptcy in the last couple of years. Kate's guest shares a new effort to rebuild the dairy economy across the nation. That's tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then corporations and think tanks write many of the bills that pop up in state legislatures around the country. We'll talk about an investigation into the scope of this so-called model legislation. I'm Rob Ferret. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Many Wisconsin Public Radio members have contributed for 30 years or more, and they want the programming that they love to be here for the next generation. Hello, I'm John Gatto, WPR's Southwest Regional Manager. You can help sustain the future of Wisconsin Public Radio by naming WPR as a beneficiary of your retirement plan. For more information, call 888-909-4163 or visit WPRLegacy.org.
Wait a minute. No, it's not. It's spring in Wisconsin, and you know what that means. It's gardening season. Larry Mueller here, inviting you to join me every Friday at 11 and Saturday morning at 6 for Garden Talk. We dig into it all, from vegetables to flowers to the soil they grow in. Get your garden ready this spring with Garden Talk on the Ideas Network, Fridays at 11 and Saturday mornings at 6, or online anytime.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Now that Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen is out, will Acting Secretary Kevin McAleenan take immigration enforcement in a more aggressive direction? As NPR